So the past few days, it's really been a journey, an adventure through Buddha Dharma, through mindfulness, its different faces, its different practices. Started with a general foundation, general practice. And we talked about the more detailed analytical side of Buddhism. Explored consciousness. Then the more practical side, the actual practice of mindfulness, how to understand consciousness doing it, how to understand our body and mind by being present to the body and mind. Then we talked about the more emotional side of Buddhism. It's an emotional side from one perspective. And then it's also just a side of compassion. Not necessarily emotion, but a response to care for not only ourselves, our own practice, but all beings. And then today, we finish with what can be seen as a synthesis of all of these teachings presented and practiced in a very simple way. Very down-to-earth way, the way it's understood and practiced in the Chan tradition, which is one branch of Chinese Buddhism. Also today, I hope to share and we can discuss about practice in daily life. And it's great that you just mentioned, you know, that this kind of training brings a routine, brings a structure. Yeah? We can talk about from the Buddhist practice, is there a way to practice in daily life with some structure? We can explore that. Is there a way to maintain and nourish our practices on a daily basis, not just going to retreat once a year or doing a training once in a blue moon, but how can we nourish our practice so that it benefits ourselves and others on a daily basis? And there should be some time for kind of free Q&A. If there are questions that didn't get addressed over these few days, this is basically our last real formal discussion time in terms of what we've learned and what we've practiced. So it can be an open discussion time, if you like. And if we really finish early, we can just have a free-form practice, a time to do silent practice in any form that you like. So we talked about so much. Hopefully some of it has stuck in mind. Definitely somewhere in there. So when I talk about things today, it'll be based on what we have already talked about. Because if we think of the Chan school, just to give a basic history of how it developed, the Chan tradition or Chan tradition being referring to the school of Buddhism that developed in China around, really took shape around the, began around the 6th century, really took shape 100 years afterwards. And I mentioned the figure Bodhidharma, remember that name, the one with the glaring eyes? That figure, Bodhidharma, was in popular culture seen as the founder of Shaolin Kung Fu. Have you seen Kung Fu movies? Shaolin Temple, monks jumping around, you know, killing people, or protecting people, huh? Yeah, seemingly cool. And the figure Bodhidharma is attributed with bringing martial arts to the Shaolin Temple. That kind of history is really popularized. He's a mythical figure to begin with. There's no clear historical documents about his life and his activity at the temple. Supposedly around the year 500-something, he traveled from India and he wanted to bring the wonderful practice of Buddhism to China. As the story goes, he arrived to China and traveled around. Eventually met with met with the emperor of China. That's big, to be able to just arrive and meet with the emperor. He must have had some kind of stature or some kind of quality about him which the emperor thought was valuable. The emperor supposedly was supporting and practicing Buddhism. He was building temples, making donations, having the sutras copied and spread throughout China. He was really a supporter of Buddhism. However, when Bodhidharma met with him, it didn't go over quite well. It wasn't the most fruitful of meetings. Just to describe the context again, during that time where the emperor was supporting Buddhism, it was flourishing, and there were already various schools of thought developing, being brought from India to China. For example, the day we talked about manifestation-only teachings, this school that analyzes consciousness was already there and developing. There were other schools really focused on doctrine, not necessarily practicing so much, but analyzing Buddhism as a whole and then categorizing the teachings. Oh, this teaching belongs to this, that teaching belongs to this, and making a very clear-cut system of understanding the doctrine of Buddhism. Almost doesn't sound very much to the spirit of the original teaching of just the Buddha sitting in the woods and talking and everyone practicing, nothing being written down, nothing being recorded. But by that time, this is already 1,000 years after the Buddha. So people wanted to preserve it, write it down, categorize it, systematize it. So in China at that time, all of these teachings were already being brought over and systematized and studied. A lot of study, a lot of scholasticism. Of course, since the emperor is supporting it, it's again flourishing. The emperor probably had some study, some training. Supposedly his tutor was very knowledgeable, very wise. But as far as the emperor goes, we don't know. He was portrayed as being a supporter of Buddhism, but maybe not so much a practitioner. And you may see by the next interaction between him and Bodhidharma that there was something amiss. Again, Bodhidharma comes to this place where Buddhism is flourishing, meets with the emperor. The interaction is kind of formal in the beginning. The emperor introduces himself, says, "My name is so-and-so, I'm the emperor here. Did you know that this is a wonderful place for Buddhism, a wonderful country for Buddhism? Did you know that, sir? And I've actually done a lot to support this development of Buddhism. Did you hear about that? You didn't? Oh, I've been building temples. I've been paying for the medicines and the needs of monastics. I've been having scriptures being written by so-and-so. I have this such-and-such. I've been doing this. I've been doing that. I've been doing this. I've been doing that." You know, kind of political talk, saying how great the country is, how great he is. Imagine Bodhidharma's face, probably just listening quietly. Yeah, maybe he was listening like this, according to his look in the painting. Probably not. And they said he cut his eyelids off so he wouldn't get drowsy. Really? Probably not. He wouldn't have eyes if he cut his eyelids off. So Bodhidharma was listening patiently. And the emperor says, "So what do you think, kind sir? What kind of merit have I gained by all of this? What merit have I gained?" And we talked about merit a little bit, right? Like the benefits of practice. When we do something, there's a good consequence or a good benefit. Reciting brings benefit. Giving brings benefit. Being mindful brings benefit and merit. The emperor was kind of looking to see how many spiritual points he had. What kind of merit did I get? What did Bodhidharma say? story?
None whatsoever.
Literal Chinese that's there is no merit. No merit.
Harsh.
Yeah. He's talking to the emperor. This is someone with big stature and probably a big, big ego. And this is not just, you know, two people, right? This is a delegation. This is a delegation welcoming this foreigner monk from India with a big beard, someone that not many people have seen before, so I'm sure he gathered people. Guess who's here? Come, come, see. The official delegation is cabinet members, maybe more visitors. He said, no merit. Imagine the atmosphere at that time. Everyone looking around. What did he just say? You know, people were probably wondering, was there an error in translation? Did he just say no merit or a lot of merit? I think he said no merit. Probably a long pause, and the emperor probably had a double take. And was that a wrong translation? And Bodhidharma was probably looking very patiently and calmly, waiting for the emperor's response. That brief encounter went down in history as a very representative story in Chan Buddhism. What happened afterwards? I'm sure we're all wondering. He didn't chop his head off or have him executed, which he could have done. He was, you know, a Buddhist. He couldn't go around killing people all the time, especially monks. I forget the exact engagement, but it went something like, after he said no merit, well, there was definitely shock. The emperor then asked, he asked a different question. He sort of changed the topic. It's like, okay, this is not getting anywhere. Something like, what is the greatest wisdom or insight in Buddhism? Something like that. Bodhidharma said there's nothing ordinary, anything holy about it. Again, it was shooting down the emperor. The emperor's looking for a holy, grand insight. It's not holy and it's not ordinary either. Again, second time, people are just like, probably all hiding their faces, looking through their fingers at what's going to happen. Okay, the emperor at this time is probably getting a little bit impatient. He got shot down twice. This is starting to feel a little impolite, inappropriate. Yes, Bodhidharma, who's this person that's standing before me? And what was Bodhidharma's response?
I don't know, Your Majesty.
I don't know. The third time, the record player stops again, and all the happy music, if there was any music playing, stopped. And then at some point, this conversation was completely going nowhere. It just ended. And okay, they finished the party. Clearly this was not for a delegation to observe. The emperor found everybody something to do. The party was broken up. Bodhidharma realized that the emperor wasn't ripe, so to speak. He wasn't ready to hear or he wasn't ready for what Bodhidharma had brought him or had helped him, tried to help him to see. Very famous story in the history of Chan Buddhism, which really goes to show the very spirit of the Chan teachings. First of all, that Chan Buddhism itself, as a culture, as a teaching, as a way, is founded on basic understanding and practice of Buddhism as it was. It was founded on what was developed within China at that time. Buddhism was already there, it was already flourishing. the emperor already knew he had merit. He knew he had merit. He was gaining benefit or bringing benefit through his works. He knew it. But he was obviously attached to what he had done. Obviously, his self was quite large. His idea of what he had done was quite special. He was practicing Buddhism for sure, but it was time for him to let go. But he wasn't ripe. Bodhidharma tried to help him. If he was ripe and he heard the words "no merit," maybe he would have learned something. What do you think he would have learned, would have understood by hearing "no merit"? What was Bodhidharma trying to say?
Is that a question? Like an open question?
Yeah, yeah. Materials and the structures he's built. And
inner work.
Yesterday he was talking about the Heart Sutra, and it's almost like no merit is like a line lifted out of the Heart Sutra. No attainment, no non-attainment. No birth.
Why does the emperor need to show himself in this way?
Or an outer authority would tell him an answer. Also, I think there's something in the Zen tradition when they talk about if you give something a desire to receive, it's actually what I mean, there's a name for it. It's a kind of poison.
All great. It's just like that. Bodhidharma wasn't really saying he has completely no merit at all. It's no benefit at all. That wouldn't be true. That would be saying as if there's nothing at all. In Buddhism, there's a practice of giving, charity. Being charitable in many different ways is a wonderful way to bring merit or bring benefit to everyone. Giving, even giving the materials, so is one of the practices. Sharing of the teaching, it's another wonderful practice. So many people can benefit. However, like you said, if there's giving that is tainted by what's called just attachment to form. The Diamond Sutra says if you give with attachment to form, that's not the best kind of giving. It's good, it's giving, and probably something that we all do naturally. We do something, we give something, and don't we kind of just want to get some, a little bit of praise, of thanks, do something nice, person doesn't say anything. We hold the door, no, we don't say anything, and just walk in. It's like, keep walking. It's like, I just held the door for you. I didn't say anything. Maybe some cultures, we expect a thanks. Other cultures, nobody expects thanks. There's no thanks. It's just that you should hold the door. But isn't it natural or almost habitual to want to get some sort of feedback when we do something, right? We help build a temple. Nobody says thanks. Nobody says, oh, this is a wonderful deed you've done. Or you know, we help build or even support a community like this. I'm sure many of you are getting more involved in supporting this community in some way. And maybe it's quite normal and natural to feel that, well, do I get thanks? Do I want to be recognized by others as being a big support of the community, right? Oh, you do so much here, it's so great. I'm so thankful for what you do. We hear that and we're like, ah, feels good, right? Feels good, feels like we want to keep doing, we want to keep supporting. But if we're really trying hard and putting our heart into it, nobody says anything. It's just like, you know, okay, I gotta do it. It's my role. I gotta do it. We may feel like we lose a bit of steam, lose a bit of enthusiasm. And maybe if we're in a place where nobody is recognizing us, nobody is thanking us, we may just leave because it feels there's no feedback at all. So naturally, we all need encouragement. We all feel like the feedback is good. But if we look closely, wanting that can become an obstruction, can be an obstacle to our practice of giving. So in the Dhamma Sutra, that's called giving while being caught in science.
Science?
Science, like stop sign or... Or being caught in forms. Our mind is dwelling in forms. We're waiting for the thanks. The form is the thanks, or the form is the smiling face that we see. Ah, oh, you do so much work. Oh, this is so great. You know, that smiling face is a form in our mind.
Can you repeat what it's called in the sentence?
Could say, a mind that's dwelling in forms. Dwelling in forms or signs. It's interesting, the character for sign or form, if you put the character for mind underneath it, it means perception. A form in the mind is a perception. How neat is that? When we see something, we see that smiling face, or we hear those pleasant words of encouragement. That's the form. And it appears in our mind. It's our perception. Sometimes maybe we perceive wrong. Someone was trying to give us thanks, but we actually took it in a different way. Either way, though, it's very habitual and common for us to dwell in forms. The emperor was dwelling in forms. What Bodhidharma was trying to say was, don't dwell in those forms. You get caught up in wanting to receive praise or acknowledgement. But the emperor didn't get it. He missed it. Right over his head. He wasn't ripe for it.
Yes, he felt like it was a judgment.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, it's like the first meeting, delegation, you don't expect that at all. Also in the Diamond Sutra it says, formless mind is the greatest kind of merit. So, wu xiang, to be without form, to be formless. To be formless doesn't mean there's really no forms there at all. That wouldn't be accurate. Doesn't mean you don't do anything at all. You don't give anymore. there's nothing there, just means that nothing gets stuck in our mind. The good that we've done, or the bad that we've received, doesn't get stuck in our mind. That's a formless mind. We still think, we still respond, we still do, but nothing gets stuck in it. We practice not letting things get stuck in it, not dwelling. That's the formless. And the formless mind is the greatest merit.
The greatest merit.
Mm-hmm. It's the greatest merit. Why? Because it's immeasurable. There's no points. It's like the immeasurable mind we talked about. It's immeasurable. It's not that we've accumulated some kind of feeling. It's like a lot of good feeling. Actually, it's just a mind with no burdens, no heaviness from being, from dwelling. That's the greatest kind of benefit.
Also, in terms like connecting this discussion to the emptiness discussion from yesterday,
mm-hmm.
is also a formless mind is also a way to let, like, the potential be.
Exactly.
It's the same. Okay.
Yeah, it's like when our mind is dwelling in on things, our potential is blocked because we're stuck there. How can Bodhidharma? How could that monk have done that to me in front of all my subjects and all of my, you know, respected cabinet members?
Mm-hmm.
He's stuck. He's not able to live his potential or fulfill his potential because he's burdened by that. If he was able to be formless, it's like, okay, that was interesting. Did I miss something? Maybe you could ask someone, did I miss something? What just happened there? Please tell me. Now he has the potential to learn, maybe see something.
Didn't that not happen though, with the following story of the son? You know, the son's, you know, a scholar who'd done a lot of work in reading the sutras and stuff, and the son convinced his father to send someone out to go to him.
I think it was like his tutor.
Yeah.
His tutor, or mentor. His mentor. Was a well-learned and well-practiced teacher, and he was like, "Hey, Emperor, I know you're probably mad about what happened, but he's a wise person." And then they tried to call him back, but there were other engagements, I believe, but he didn't go back, at least not right away. And then he went to Shaolin Temple to retreat. He's like, okay, folks are not ready for this right now. The other monks he was talking to, they're all scholars, they're all talking about all this complicated theory. He's like, all right, I'm just gonna go retreat for a while. And it's said that he went to retreat in a cave and meditate for 9 years or something. Again, he didn't just sit still for 9 years. But he sat in a cave and lived there. And probably some of the nearby people had heard about him and come to see him, ask questions. And his first disciple actually called upon him, and that's another story, when he called upon Bodhidharma. He knew that this person wasn't just an ordinary fellow. Now, this is the meaning of what Bodhidharma was trying to say in the context of Chan Buddhism. Buddhism was flourishing, yet at first it didn't seem that folks were quite ripe for what Bodhidharma's message was. Supposedly he gave some teachings, and later on they were recorded, and there's a collection of his teachings in the Chan records, something called like the Bloodstream Sermon. Bloodstream Sermon was probably the well-known one. Hard to say if he spoke it or if he wrote it. It's attributed to him. And it's the beginning of the so-called direct approach of Chan Buddhism, sudden approach to practice and insight. Chan tradition is known for this sudden awakening or instant enlightenment, a term and an idea that's spawned a lot of misunderstanding, but very, very attractive, right? There's an instant way. There's a sudden way to enlightenment. I like this Chan stuff. I want this way. I don't want the slow way, I want the sudden way. We'll talk about misunderstanding later. What's called fast food Zen. The direct approach could be summarized by a line from one of Bodhidharma's teachings. And it's often a sentence that summarizes the approach of Chan, pointing directly to the nature of the human mind. Pointing directly to the nature of the human mind. And his way to do that, how do we do that? What does that mean? Point to my mind. He just says to let go of true, false, holy, unholy, right, wrong, and directly perceive one's own nature. Basically, he's saying to let go of the discriminating mind, let go of all those concepts that sometimes are useful, but if we get caught in concepts, then our mind is stuck on forms. He says, put down the discriminating mind, let go of that function of consciousness, even just for a moment, and very simply and directly, we'll perceive what is called our nature. Perceive interbeing. Perceive emptiness. Or fullness. Wait, where did you go? And then he goes on to say, if we can't do that though, that's called entering by principle. If we can't enter by just that simple principle, then we practice gradually. Practice from the basics. That's the beginning of the spirit of the Chan tradition, recognizing that practice is useful and important, but it's not like you have to go through a definite set of stages or a definite period of time or a definite sequence of practices. Some traditions were saying that. They have a complete map of how to practice and how to eventually realize awakening. Step one, step two, step three, step four. First you do a certain number of prostrations, then you have to do giving for a certain number of years, then you have to copy and recite a sutra a few thousand times, then you have to practice samadhi, cultivate all the samadhis first, then you practice mindfulness, so on and so on and so on. There's already very regimented, structured ways to practice by this time. Bodhidharma is trying to help people see that those practices are very useful, very valuable. There's a lot of merit to them. However, the process and insight is not a fixed thing. It could happen any moment. It can be any moment. Just like we said earlier, one moment of mindfulness, one moment of pure, simple mindfulness, can be a moment of insight. It's the same thing, what he's saying. It just depends on how much discrimination is really happening. We can't just say like, okay, I could do that, let's do it now. Just gonna be mindful of looking at the floor. Not thinking about anything. Not wondering what time it is. Is that it? Huh?
I believe you can do it.
But all of us can do it. But even though we could concentrate through mindfulness for a few moments, feel that the mind is very clear and even very quiet, no distracting thoughts or worries, is that seeing our nature, or seeing the nature of things? Is that insight? Again, it really depends. Is there still discrimination there? Is there still that me happening in the background? Which most likely it is. Even when our mind is very clear and quiet, it's like, I am experiencing this, I am experiencing this, I am experiencing this. A subtle discrimination that's going, still running. But in principle, it can be any moment. So the path of practice, there are tools, there are methods, it's all beneficial, but it's not fixed. We shouldn't get too caught up in that process, too caught up in those regimens and routines, which are good. That's what he's saying. That's another neat story. Do you want to hear it? The story about Bodhidharma and his disciple? The stories are fun. Huh?
Story of what? Sorry?
Him and his disciple. His first disciple. It's a little gory, but it's memorable. For some reason, there's quite a few gory stories that came out of the Chan tradition. I don't know what that's about. When he was in the cave for all that time, not coming out, and there was a monk who was nearby, and he heard about Bodhidharma. He's like, I'm going to go see this so-called great master from India, see what he's about. And he went to pay respects and to visit, call upon him. He showed up many times at the door, knocking at the cave. Hello? No answer. Hello? No answer. Goes deeper. Hello? It's Bodhidharma probably just sitting there. The eyes. Bodhidharma didn't answer him. It's almost like, that's my interpretation. I won't put that in just yet. Bodhidharma didn't answer him. So this monk, Hui Ke, his name, Hui Ke, one who's able in wisdom, came many times. Bodhidharma didn't pay any attention to him, didn't answer him. But Hui Ke still had this mind of wanting to know, what is it? What is it, this wisdom that this monk has? I know I can learn something. And he knew himself, he didn't really understand Buddhism. He was a monk who was practicing for a long time. Supposedly he was even really good at debating with people. He was smart. But he knew he didn't really experience it from his heart. He kept going back, kept going back, kept going back. No response from Bodhidharma. By that time it was winter, snowing, a couple of feet of snow on the ground. Hui Ke sitting outside the cave in the snow, kneeling, waiting, kneeling. Bodhidharma knows he's there. He sees him there. Hui Ke's waiting, waiting in the snow. Waiting for so long. Kneeling. Imagine that. Just imagine kneeling for like a couple of hours on rocks, on a stone floor in a cave. Not pleasant. Not easy to endure. Now imagine it's snowing. Your knees, your clothes are wet, your feet are wet, you're cold. It's freezing. He's still kneeling there. As the legend goes, to show his even greater determination, he chopped off his own hand. You got to do it to get his attention. He figured, okay, I got to get his attention somehow. Yeah, that's another one. But that's a legend. Again, this is not so much historical fact. That was to show his determination. Probably likely that just kneeling in the snow for so long may have been just enough to show his determination. And Bodhidharma eventually said, hi. Can I help you?
Yes, I can speak.
Right. was stained in blood, of course. They said, you know, hey, noticed you were waiting for a long time. Come on in, have some tea. Sit down. Dry off your clothes. Hmm?
Oh, he will hold the tea cup now.
Oh,
right.
I was imagining he didn't really chop off his arm. I was assuming that part was a little exaggerated. So, if you want to be with me on this part of the story, he still has two arms. There's no bleeding, there's no gore. He still has both his two arms. Bodhidharma says, come on, come in for some tea. Sit down. Dry yourself off. It's cold. Here, keep warm. You can't assume Bodhidharma is a completely cold and ruthless, heartless person, although it makes for a good legend in that story. Come on, warm yourself up. You have a question? I've noticed you've been here for quite a few days. What's on your mind? Huika says, I can't put my mind at peace. I've been practicing for so many years. As you can see, I'm a monk. I've been studying, practicing, meditating. I can debate with anyone, and I can win. But I really don't feel in my heart that I know it. What was the Buddha's insight? It's not mine. And I can't put my mind at ease. And you know what Bodhidharma said? Who knows this? What he said? Become Catholic.
Have some more tea.
Think again.
That's good. I like have some more tea. Become Catholic is interesting. Well, you know, if this isn't working for you, there are other religions that are quite good. On my way here, I passed a Catholic church. That could work for you. What else did he say, you know? Any others? Have some tea is nice. Have some more tea.
From today comes to my mind, do some restorative yoga.
Say again?
Today we done this restorative yoga, so I would suggest, you know,
do like a pose, and
yeah.
Do some yoga. And Bodhidharma was attributed to bringing martial arts to Shaolin. Maybe he said, let me show you a few moves. You know, it's your heart chakra that needs some fine-tuning. Yeah? Bodhidharma said, your mind is not at peace? Where's your mind? Show it to me. See that? She did the motion of chopping the arm off. That's the second or the first time? I guess it's only chop your own arm off once. So. Then show me your mind. Interesting question, right?
Mm. No.
No? But Huiko was actually struck by that question. It hit him. Similar, almost like no merit. Seems like an irrational, impossible statement. He said, show me your mind. But Huiko, his reaction and his response was, he started to look for his own mind. What was it that really wasn't at peace? What was really bothering him? Looking for his mind. What is my mind that's not at peace? In one sense, you could say he was all of a sudden becoming mindful of his mind. Mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of what's arising. He started to actually look inwards at himself. What is it? Where's my mind that feels ill at ease? But there was also another element, kind of questioning mind, a very deep and powerful wanting to know, what is it? What is it that's really bothering me? Because he also wanted to know, what is insight? What is it like? How can you do it? Ball of questioning was brewing in him for a long time. Bodhidharma just really pushed the right button or popped, you could say, the balloon of doubt and questioning that was building up in him came to a crescendo. And suddenly, he understood. He understood his mind. It wasn't like, boom, he had an idea. You know, saying, oh, it's my Buddha nature. Thanks, Bodhidharma. But it was the questioning, burdensome, dwelling in forms, mind, that just suddenly stopped. He dropped all those questions. He dropped the thought of feeling not peaceful. He saw clearly what that was. Just dropped away. All of that dropped away. And then Bodhidharma said, looks like I just calmed your mind for you. Or, is your mind at peace now? And that was the first, you could say, what's called mind-to-mind transmission that the Chan tradition talks about. A very intimate connection between two people. One person recognizing the insight of another person just based on this very simple but clear connection. Recognition that a person has dropped all of their burdens, all of their discrimination, and has realized a moment of perfect mindfulness. It's called mind-to-mind transmission. This tradition of one person recognizing the insight of another person is a big thing in the Chan tradition. There's a lot of importance placed on that. It's kind of like a mentor recognizing an apprentice has achieved mastery in something. You know, stone carver recognizes the mastery of the apprentice and gives them the seal or certificate of mastery. You now have your license. Or the yoga trainer gives you the certificate. You've completed your training, your hours. This is your seal, it's your certificate. It's recognizing the person has a certain degree of mastery. This is passed on from generation to generation, this mind-to-mind transmission, recognizing that insight of the person. It's very simple, very ordinary, very straightforward. But again, it's all based on the foundation of that person having put in the work beforehand. Hui Ke was studying and practicing very hard. He's been training for years. You could say he was ripe. And also that questioning mind within him that was building, that came to a point of, you could say, being ripe and ready to drop it. So the so-called sudden enlightenment that the Chan tradition talks about is founded on gradual practice. It's not just you show up for your class and boom, here's your license. You know, one day, here's your license. Or one first meditation, we're waiting for it to happen. That's the misunderstanding that was perpetuated for quite a while, especially when Zen came to the West. The whole idea of sudden enlightenment, people got into a craze where they just, I hear there's this 7-day retreat. You can go on it, and in 7 days, guaranteed enlightenment. I mean, it's 7 days. Just think about it. 7 days of meditation. Something's got to happen. Yeah, something's got to happen. Let's go. This mind of expectation, this culture of sudden enlightenment, people got into a lot of trouble and had a lot of problems with that expectation and with their trainers thinking that it's also possible. Trainers waiting with a stick, walking around, kind of like the militant Zen that we talked about, waiting for the right moment. You know, and people sitting there waiting, yes, when's he gonna come and hit me? Just hit me and I'm gonna have the insight, I can feel it. That's like... That's like the, again, the twisted view, twisted expectation unrealistic view. Only bad things happen in those situations, and people eventually gave up and said, this Zen stuff is nonsense. This is really not possible. So the realistic, more mature view is sudden insight. This moment of perfect mindfulness is born from consistent, gradual practice, nurturing all those seeds, developing our mindfulness, becoming more charitable, developing joyfulness, kindness, compassion. All of that is part of it. But at any time, there's no specific time, there's no specific stage, at any time, we can have a completely clear moment of mindfulness. So that questioning mind in the Chan tradition later on became called the Huatou. Huatou, Chinese for before words or before thought. Moment of mind cleansed or free from the burden of thought, burden of attachment to thought. That's Huatou. The method of first developing that questioning mind. First, take up a question. What is mind? What is Buddha nature all about? What is Buddha nature? What is my own nature? What is my own mind before it has discrimination? It could be different questions to generate this questioning mind that Hui Ke had. It's a kind of method, can be a kind of method that comes from this, all these different stories, and the fact that a person can first develop a complete, overwhelming, and heavy sense of questioning as an approach to practice. That's something quite unique to the Chan tradition. You don't really see that in earlier Buddhism. It is in some places. You don't see it so much. That's one approach, one method within the Chan tradition that's very well-known. Huatou method, questioning mind. The other method, which I'd like to introduce and we can practice together after the break, we'll practice silent illumination. Those of you who've been on the 7-day retreat, I think that was mentioned, yeah? Silent illumination. Another approach to practice, very simple and straightforward. Very similar to what we did with mindfulness, but I'll show how it's even simpler in its application. So one, the Huatou method, one, silent illumination. These are the two methods which are often seen and transmitted in the Chan tradition. Generation after generation, it's been passed down and recognized. But just another word about this whole transmission thing. This is another thing that's been become a kind of problem in the Zen and Chan tradition. Because there's the idea that when someone has seen their nature, so to speak, when someone has had that moment of perfect mindfulness, it is a powerful thing. It is a life-changing experience. After that experience, someone very clearly knows what is suffering and how is it happening. They've experienced and have been very mindful of their own suffering and have experienced at least one moment or a few moments of that being absent, that sense of self, that constant selfing being absent. It's a very different perspective. However, it doesn't mean the person is all of a sudden like a superhuman or some holy saint, no longer capable of doing anything wrong, no longer capable of making mistakes. That's not what it means. However, when Buddhism came to the West, that really became mystified. And the whole mind-to-mind thing, it's very esoteric, it's almost secretive in a way, it becomes very mystical. you hear that Captain Z? Yeah, I heard he saw the nature. Yeah, he did? Yeah, what happened? I don't know. I just saw him go into the interview room and, you know, I heard something about enlightenment, something. You know, the teacher gave the student enlightenment or recognized their enlightenment, maybe publicly announced it. So and so, Mr. Z, Captain Z, has realized enlightenment, and I affirm it. And maybe that person is given also a new level of responsibility within the community, a new authority. Because, yeah, working up the ladder, they could be given authority in a good way, because they may have a very clear vision of what the practice is, so they can help other people. It's the positive side. We know the negative side is this could be a very political thing where they're put in an authority position. Now they can manipulate that, manipulate others with that authority. That's one problem with this whole lineage thing, this whole secret transmission thing, recognizing someone's enlightenment, calling someone enlightened, and all the assumptions that go along with that. Does that mean that so-and-so is now a saint? Does that mean they're perfect? Everything they say is right? Everything they do is right? No mistakes? In Buddhist circles, I've really seen that attitude persist. And it's very dangerous and very unfortunate. Even within my own tradition, some people would say like, hey, well, isn't so-and-so enlightened? So I couldn't be wrong. And I even thought that myself to some degree. Like, I saw so-and-so as this a Dharma heir of my teacher, so I look at them as like watching them. You know, everything they do, from like picking up a pen to picking up drinking tea, you know, how do they walk, how do they put their shoes on, just kind of watching everything. Is that what enlightened people do? I guess that's how enlightened people do it. Oh, I guess they just slip their shoes on instead of using their hands. That's the more enlightened way to do things. I was very naive in that sense and saw a lot of that with others over the years. Looking at someone who has seen their nature, very ordinary moment of clarity and mindfulness, seeing them as superhuman, and then losing their own sense of judgment. Sometimes just bowing to authority, totally losing their rationality. Of course, you may have heard stories of what happens when people abuse their authority within Buddhism, within any other spiritual tradition. That's a tragedy. And it happens. It's like a combination of authority and a combination of what's called spiritual materialism. Believing that spiritual authority is now somehow not just human authority, it's not just the president, not just the prime minister, it's not just whoever the top dog is, it's even higher than that because it's spiritual. It's like holy. I hope everybody knows that the authority or the lineage of Zen and Chan Buddhism, its initial purpose was just to say, hey, this person has reliable experience. You could learn from them. Something to learn from them. And the way they teach method and understand the Dharma, it's reliable. Kind of just like a certificate. Yeah? To have a professor teach in a university, you can't just show up and say, hey, I'm going to teach. You know, I know a lot about this subject. I do. You're laughing. I know a lot about this subject. Yeah. How about I teach a class? Yeah. I won't expect a high salary. No, that's not going to happen. Person needs some sort of credential. People need to see credential. That's how this lineage and transmission thing continues. It's a useful thing, can be a useful thing. But then it's important to recognize the detrimental side and to not get caught up in the view that enlightenment makes a person perfect, or seeing the nature makes us perfect. And that once we have a moment of perfect mindfulness, everything else is going to be like smooth sailing for the rest of our life. It's not like that. The more accurate thing is that a moment of seeing the nature brings us a lot of clarity and can relieve a lot of doubts. We start to see the practice very clearly. We start to see ourselves very clearly. And again, we continue to practice. We continue to have stronger mindfulness, clearer mindfulness, more moments of that simple, plain, direct perception. It's called enlightenment. It's direct perception. More and more. More gradual practice. Gradual practice leads to sudden enlightenment and is then again followed by more gradual practice. So then, what naturally follows is the most useful attitude is that the practice itself is the goal. Practice itself is the goal. That can relieve so much expectation, wrong ideas. Since we're just always going to continue practicing, enlightened or not, having that perfect mindfulness or not, we're just going to keep we have to keep practicing. We keep experiencing the benefits of it. And the moment of practice is a moment of benefit. Moment of mindfulness is a moment of equanimity, joy, kindness, compassion. That's the most useful, practical mindset, which the masters remind us again and again. So again, in that sense, it's not attaining anything, not gaining or losing anything. Using the mind skillfully. Using the mind mindfully.
How did you form it again? Moment of mindfulness is?
Moment of?
Infinity.
You could even stretch it to say a moment of mindfulness is a moment of insight. So all of these teachings of Chan Buddhism, the so-called direct path, founded based on the indirect path, gradual practice. We could say, in that sense, it's almost like the PhD of Buddhism, or it's when we have our PhD, then someone takes it away from us. It's the right time. Okay, we've earned our PhD, we've earned our certificate, someone takes it away from us and burns it, so we don't get so attached to it. That's what you see when you read Chan records. It's really not complete. Most of the stories are kind of like the story of Bodhidharma. No merit. Someone comes to a teacher. What do I do when I meet with a Buddha? Kill him. Another Chan master said that. What if I go near a place where there's Buddhism? What should I do? Well, if you go near a place where there's the Buddha, keep walking past. If you get to a place where there's no Buddha, make sure not to stay there. All these kinds of stories. It's really helping a person to let go of even their attachment to the practice. And is it possible that as yoga teachers, we may feel a sense of achievement, accomplishment, for now that we've worked up the ladder. We're like, ha-ha, I'm here. And all of you folks, you yoga fledglings, you're down there. It's possible. Maybe after being a teacher for 20 years, 30 years, it's easier to have that sort of expert mind, a holy mind. So it would be very beneficial if someone were to come along and pull that away somehow. That's the culture of Zen, the culture of Chan, the chan. Pulling the rug out from under your feet. The rug has to be there first. If there's no rug, there's nothing to be done. Yeah, Tatiana. Humiliate someone. So hopefully that's just clearer about the background, the history, kind of conceptual approach of Chan. I didn't mention any sutras, but there are discourses of the Buddha that different Chan masters used to illustrate their point. The Diamond Sutra, Heart Sutra, of course, the Sutra of Complete Enlightenment. Make a list in case you were curious to read these sutras. My teacher has translations and commentaries, which may be helpful. But again, it's not about the words. Thank you, everyone.